Welcome to Classical Companion. I'm Diane Jones, and over these weeks and months, I'm chatting with artists and musicians throughout the region, throughout the country, about the music they are turning to in these challenging times. Today, I'm so pleased to have Aaron Wunsch and Julia Bruskin. Aaron is a marvelous pianist. Julie is a fantastic cellist, and they are also the co-artistic directors of the Skene Atlas Festival. Aaron and Julia, thank you so much for taking some time out. I know you've got kids, so it's a juggling act, but taking time out to talk to us today about this music that you're turning to.
Thank you, Diane. It's great to be with you again.
Great to be here. Thank you.
I miss not having you in the studios live, but we will get back to that eventually. I know we will.
Okay. Yes.
Before we start talking about the music, I'm checking in with folks, and just tell us how you're doing, because this has had a big effect on you, both with the Skene Atlas Festival and with your other responsibilities at Juilliard and with the Met Opera Orchestra. So how are you all doing right now?
We're doing okay. We're getting by and we're staying hopeful. This has created major challenges for everyone all over the world. For us personally, I mean, we're still in our apartment home in New York on the Upper West Side. Our two kids, who are 4 and 7, are with us all the time, which is a blessing and a challenge. I've become kind of a full-time teacher, and I have immense more respect than I ever did before, and I had a lot of respect before for the teachers who help them and nurture them during the days at school, because doing it all myself, I see a lot of the challenges they go through and also, you know, the joys, but it's a big job. So that's been taking up a lot of my time, but also keeping me centered in a way. I think these times are hardest when you get too wrapped up in the news and what's coming and what's going to happen next year. And my kids keep me very much in the now, which I appreciate. And I think music does also. For both of us, we're still playing and playing together a little bit. We have the blessing of being able to play together in our home, which is great, Aaron and I. And my orchestra is not able to play at all. The Met has been canceled through the end of the season, and we're certainly staying actively involved in what their plans are upcoming. We did have a very nice virtual at-home gala for the Met. The orchestra participated in through the feat of technology of having all those people coordinated together by a great engineer. But that was a really exciting and fun thing to be able to be part of in this time. My trio is also not playing, but all of us are thinking about and trying to do what we can make sure that when we are able to play again for a live audience, that everything will be in place for that.
In addition to being a first grade classroom and a preschool classroom, our apartment is now also a Juilliard classroom.
Mm-hmm.
I've been teaching all of my lessons and classes via Zoom, which presents various challenges. Our students are all over the world now. So, you know, it's a strange thing of at once being very connected and being very disconnected at the same time.
It definitely is a new way of doing things, and it's amazing how quickly everyone is really adapting, and that's something to be very proud of. You have not made a firm decision yet to cancel Skene Atlas Festival. So tell us the status of the Skene Atlas Festival at the moment. Everything is always, of course, changeable right now.
Yes, we are staying hopeful still that we'll be able to have a Skene Atlas Festival this summer, or to have a version of it that would be safe in this time. Obviously, our first concern is for the safety and health of all of our audience members, our performers, our volunteers. So we're staying, very in touch with the news and other organizations in the area. We're thinking a lot about contingency plans and what could be done if certain things can't be done. But we have not made a decision yet, and we are remaining hopeful because we would hate to lose that ability to connect with our wonderful audience and to be together with live music. But we'll only do it if it's safe.
And I think that's admirable. It's a difficult decision that so many organizers are having to make right now. But I'm very proud that everyone is making the right decision because, like you, the consideration is, can we do this safely? And that makes all the difference.
Indeed. And I think we appreciate more than ever the work that you're doing, Diane, to bring music to people in a way that's still possible right now. So thank you.
Oh, absolutely. My pleasure. Music is kind of our escape in these times. That brings us to a good opportunity to talk about the music that the two of you have chosen. Before we talk about the individual pieces, talk about what you were thinking about as you were putting this list together, because you've not only given me pieces, but you've given me kind of categories as well.
Well, first we started to think about how music is functioning for us in these times, and what it's bringing us as we make music in our homes and listen to music ourselves. I would say that playing music has become very precious to us. It used to be something we did sometimes because we have to. You know, we have a performance coming up and we have to get ready. And right now it's functioning a little bit differently. And I think we find ourselves making music differently when we're playing. I find that I'm eager for each note to have a message or a meaning to it. And the notes themselves seem more precious and more valuable somehow.
I would also say that in this time, I mean, we do have all these amazing things like Zoom and FaceTime and that keep us connected so much. But there's a level of human connection that we have when we're together with people, when we're talking, when we're hugging someone or, you know, interacting in real time, in real space, that we're missing right now. And I think that for me, music is, it's no substitute, but it comes the closest in a way to making us feel that connection to our humanity, you know, the range of emotions and the fullness of experience that we would have of really being with other people. And I think, you know, it's certainly not a substitute, but it's something that I turn to when I'm feeling the lack of that togetherness.
And I do think that even though we're not connected in a live setting, this is a time when we realize just how powerful music and art can be and how far it goes beyond entertainment to really offer us a deep reflection of, as Julie said, of our humanity, and it even offers us hope for a path forward.
You've broken down your list into segments, and so let's start at the top of your list, and you've got three works here listed as having a larger sense of time or eternity. Let's start with the Bach and talk us through what you were thinking and what it is about this Bach that drew you in.
Well, this piece has been a favorite of ours for a long, long time. It's the opening movement from Bach's cantata, Gottes Zeit ist die allerbeste Zeit, or God's sense of time is the best sense of time. One thing we were thinking about in music is the way that music can give you a sense of time which goes beyond the present and reminds us that although we're going through this thing which seems to drag on and on, in reality, time is a much bigger experience beyond this present moment. And in some way, that's comforting to realize that, you know, again, this won't go on forever. This cantata that Bach wrote he wrote it when he was rather young. It's a funeral cantata, but instead of starting the cantata with sad music, he starts it with music which is very comforting to remind the listener that although this moment may bring grief, that there is this larger sense of whatever you want to call it, spirituality, which eternity brings us a sense of calm and a sense of repose.
We chose to listen to it in this case in a very, very beautiful arrangement by Georgi Kurtag for piano, four hands, meaning two people sitting together at one piano and playing together. I love this piece also in its original, but in this version, there's a real intimacy and delicacy to it. The performers, when they play it, sit very close together and sometimes their fingers touch and overlap. And I think that sort of gives the music some of its poignancy and pathos, is this feeling of closeness. I will also mention that this was when we got married. I walked down the aisle to this piece, so it has a special intimacy for me that way also.
Oh, let's take a listen. I found that recording for piano, four hands. This is piano duo Takahashi Lehman.
Thank you.
Julie, you were saying that you walk down the aisle to this, and I think that often is what brings music to the fore for us, is the situation in which it became special to us, whether it's the first time we learned it, the first time we played it, walking down the aisle. Is that the case with some of these other works as well?
Certainly. I mean, I think you're right. It sort of shows how important music is to us, that when we have a major life event like a wedding or a graduation or a funeral, you know, we can't imagine these events without music. And I think that music kind of elevates the moment. It gives importance and emotion and kind of brings people together in a way that we always turn to in these moments of great importance in our lives. So, yeah, no, I mean, looking at some of these other pieces that we've chosen, I think Messiaen's Quartet for the End of Time is a piece that's been very important to me for a long time. I played it and got to know it, learned it first when I was in college studying at Juilliard. And my trio, the Claremont Trio, did a kind of intensive study of the piece with Peter Serkin, who we've just lost tragically this year, but was a terrific artist and just a person who spent a lot of his career playing this piece and advocating for it in a way that was really powerful. It was terrific to work with him. And this movement that we'll hear is a movement for cello and piano, the Louange à l'Éternité de Jésus. And it is a very, this piece is for the end of time, thinking about what will happen after the apocalypse, really. And when it was written during World War II, while Messiaen was in a camp in a very desperate situation. And I think the music is his kind of meditation on what music can mean when it seems like everything else has been lost, or where there's no hope in anything, but he put his hope in music and in faith for him. This piece, it does really take our sense of normal time in music, which we usually think of as tempo, and stretches it to something much, much slower and more kind of everlasting than any other piece of music that I know. It has some special challenges for the performers in that way, because it requires, you know, to use very, 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 very long bows and to kind of feel a pulse that's much slower than even, you know, a heartbeat or something that would feel like a normal pulse. But I think when you kind of give yourself up to that, performing it and listening to it can be a really moving and powerful experience. And so I hope it will be so for our listeners.
I have a marvelous performance here with Julian Lloyd Webber on cello and John Lenihan on piano, music from the Quartet for the End of Time by Messiaen. Now, from Messiaen, we go to Arvo Pärt, and this piece has shown up on other lists as well. I think it's a remarkable piece. What brought Spiegel im Spiegel to this list for you?
Well, again, there's a sense of timelessness in it. I mean, Spiegel im Spiegel means mirror in mirror, and if you've ever seen one of those illusions where you see a mirror on both sides of you and it looks like it goes on forever in all directions, that's a little bit the way this piece works. The remarkable thing about it, I think, is that there's so little musical material in it. It's very, very simple. So what happens as you listen to the same chords repeat is that you start to be aware of how music moves through time. Instead of focusing on the notes themselves or the emotions, you start to become aware of time in the moment. And I think this is one thing that music can do so well for us, is to create the sense of time that we feel in our lives and the way that time moves, so that you know, we have a process of mourning or grief, which then gives way to gradual healing, and we come into a better place. And the way that music can move through time, I think, can mirror those experiences. And so the way that you feel at the beginning of this piece may be very different than the way that you feel later in the piece, even though the same chords are being repeated, are coming back again and again. And I think that's quite amazing and expressive in an unusual way.
It's a beautiful piece, and I will confess, one of my favorites. And this is a performance with Angèle Dubeau on the violin, accompanied by Louise-André Baril on piano. Arvo Pärt's Spiegel im Spiegel. Wraps up the time and eternity segment of what you've given me, and you've given me a piece that you've labeled mourning. What brought you to mourning, and what brought you to this piece to reflect mourning?
Well, I should say that listeners may hear emotions in music differently, and just because I hear it that way doesn't mean that everyone needs to hear it that way. But this is a piece that's very close to me. It's the slow movement from Ravel's Piano Concerto. And although it's a piano concerto with piano and orchestra, when the movement starts, it's just the piano by itself. And the way that the music moves is almost like footsteps, like a lonely person walking. And it's very contemplative, and it sounds sad to me. It sounds like someone who's thinking about something which has been lost. But gradually the movement transforms and starts to become more and more reflective, but then also starts to uplift you as the orchestra comes in, almost to imitate those around you who share your sense of loss or mourning, and then supports you on your path and ultimately find recovery. And so I find this movement very special. I played it about a year or so ago with the dance company. So it's very special to me personally.
I have a performance here with Martha Argerich at the keyboard. This is the slow movement from Ravel's Piano Concerto in G major. Now, you've traveled from mourning to comfort, and that seems a logical progression. Talk to us a little about the works that you've chosen in your section labeled comfort, and you're starting with another work by Ravel.
Yes, that's just a coincidence, I guess. but yes, music, I think most of us would agree that music provides us with comfort, and I don't think one needs to listen to soothing music to be comforted even. It's just the experience of listening to music, whatever kind of music it is, can take us outside of ourselves and leaves us in a better place in a mysterious way. But this first work from Ravel's Mother Goose Suite, I've always loved. In just a couple of minutes, Ravel is able to walk us on a musical path. It's called The Fairy's Garden. Again, you could interpret this however you want, but there's a sense of transformation in the music. And that process of transformation, I find very comforting. It starts in a measured way. There are feelings of sadness there as well. And by the end, this garden, so to speak, transforms and becomes full of light. And there are glissandos. And it's just a reminder that our lives and our emotions can be transformed and will be transformed. And that wherever we are now is not going to be the place we're in the future.
Let's listen to a little more music from Ravel, The Fairy's Garden, from his Mother Goose Suite. From an orchestral work, now we're going to a piano trio. And Julie, I suspect you may have played this at some point.
Yes, Fauré's Piano Trio is one of my favorite trios, one that my trio loves to play as well. It's one of his last works, his Opus 120. His late style has a very unique use of harmony and one that I find very extremely beautiful and unusual and enchanting in a way. This movement is like a song to the instruments, has a chance to sing it. He uses in it something very special, I think, where the violin and the cello of the trio play in actual unison, not just in octaves where one plays the same note and the cello plays it down an octave a little lower, but they play actually the same notes, and it has this feeling of closeness and togetherness and a texture that's really unique. I think you'll hear the harmonies shifting in this way. It's sort of instead of them feeling like one harmony causes the next one, it feels like it's always kind of floating through one harmonic place to the next. And Fauré uses that to build these extremely long phrases, sometimes feeling like they're just evolving and growing and kind of drifting in a way that's very special. So I love playing this piece, and it's certainly one that's brought me comfort.
Let's listen to Fauré's Andantino from his piano trio, Opus 120. Brahms is on your list next, and Brahms does continue to come up on these lists. Tell us a little bit about this work that you've chosen from his German Requiem.
Sure. Brahms wrote a very unorthodox Requiem in the history of Requiem. Instead of using the traditional Catholic Mass for the Dead, he chose Bible verses himself that spoke to him. And it's a very comforting piece of music. It's not one that speaks to the terror of death or sin. The first line here, blessed are they who carry sorrow, for they will be comforted, seem to really fit this theme of comfort that music can do so well. There's such a warmth to Brahms' music. It's almost like you know, putting a warm blanket around yourself in sound. And I think that he's beloved for that sound, which seems to immediately wrap around us and enfold us. And the music certainly does that here.
Some music from Brahms' German Requiem, Blessed Are They Who Carry Sorrow. That was Simon Rattle leading the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra and chorus with a bit of Brahms' German Requiem. And that brings us to the next section of the list that you've given us, and you've titled it Truth. Why truth and why these works?
I guess this takes a little explanation. Sometimes we think about music as creating an illusion. But I also think that music can speak to us in a mysterious way that seems more real or more truthful than words can do that. Mendelssohn wrote about this once, that music can speak more specifically than words can ever do. And I've been playing some Schubert at the keyboard recently. I've been learning this impromptu. It's just the first thing that came to me that I wanted to play for some reason, and I had never learned it. But Schubert's music, I think, even though we think of the beauty of the sound in Schubert's music and how it sings, I often think that his music speaks directly to our life experiences and what we live. And I find myself playing the music a little differently, thinking about that aspect of it and, you know, what it can mean for our lives.
I have a performance here from Maria João Pires of the Schubert Impromptu No. 3, Opus 142. The other work that you have on your section on truth comes from Charles Ives, from his Concord Sonata. And this is another piano sonata, so Aaron, I'm kind of assuming this came by way of you.
It's true, but Julie's heard me play it so many times, she can talk about it.
I have to say, I put it on the list before Aaron thought of it.
Really?
It was a piece, actually, that when I first met Aaron, he was working on quite a lot, and I heard him play it a lot and fell in love with the piece, certainly. Especially as he plays it. The piece is the Concord Sonata. I've based it upon four different transcendentalist thinkers from Concord. I actually grew up not too far from Concord, and Aaron and I visited there together, and so the place has a lot of meaning for us. We actually recently watched the newer version of Little Women as well, which sort of brought us back into the world of the Alcotts. But this movement, I mean, it's actually about...
It's a portrait of the Alcotts as a family. So it speaks to family life in the home, and that's something we've been thinking about. But it connects that scene of the home to much larger transcendentalist theme. There's a melody that floats through it called the Human Face Melody, which he uses throughout the Concord Sonata. There's moments of dissonance in it and cataclysm, which, you know, remind us that we're part of a larger universe and a larger, you know, humanity. So I like the way that it connects this sort of domestic theme to these much larger universal themes.
Let's take a listen to music of Charles Ives, the Alcotts, from his Piano Sonata No. 2. And I found actually a performance by Charles Ives, so I've got that to share. Bit of an old performance, but that was Charles Ives with his own Piano Sonata No. 2, the Alcotts. Now, from Truth, your last section, there are three pieces in this last section, you're calling a celebration of life. I'm sure we all feel why you've done that, but why have you chosen that concept and why have you chosen these works?
Well, I think this is one of the things that music can do so powerfully for us in this time, is to remind us of life, remind us of the things that bring us joy, of moments in our lives or people who you know, make us feel joy. And I think to remind us that these times will come again, and that even within this time, there are things that bring all of us joy. There are things that renew our faith in humanity, people doing great things for each other, essential workers working so hard on our behalf. All of these things remind us of the power of life and humanity. And I think music can really bring that quality to the forefront in our hearts and our minds. The first one we chose was from Bernstein's Candide, which is a wonderful musical, kind of a farce. We had it performed at the Skinny Atlas Festival in 2018 in a terrific performance with the Knights Chamber Orchestra and a terrific group of singers. And the piece that we chose to listen to today is the finale of that whole operetta called Make Our Garden Grow. In this story of Candide, for those who've read the book or seen the whole musical production, it's a wild story where all kinds of disasters and bizarre things take place, a lot of adventures. But in the end, Candide comes back to the woman that he loves and he says, well, all of this, you know, for whatever didn't work, for whatever we've lost, we come home and we keep things simple. We go back to just the simple things of life, having a home life that's joyful, working together as a family and making our garden grow. It's about getting back to the simple things in life. And I think that's something that many of us are doing right now, certainly that we feel that we're doing with our family, coming back to the things that are very simple and essential and bring us joy from those simple things.
Here's Leonard Bernstein conducting the London Symphony Orchestra and Chorus with Make Our Garden Grow from his operetta Candide. Next we have, and Julie, I'll confess, I'm going to play you. I'm going to play the Claremont Trio for this work. Oh, so talk to us about the Mendelssohn.
Sure. This is a piece that my trio played in our very first month together, and one that I've always really, really loved. We played it actually in our New York debut, which was the first time that Aaron ever heard me perform, and we met right around the time of that concert. So it's one that goes back to the beginning of our relationship, but also of my trio's time working together. The whole trio is terrific, but I think the last movement to me is just a really spectacular piece of music in that it has kind of a journey from this wild kind of vigorous dance that's in minor, seems not severe, but a little bit stern in its tone, but also kind of with a joyful rhythm to it. And Mendelssohn, who really loved the work of Bach, and kind of Mendelssohn was very instrumental in bringing Bach's music back into concert halls, and he led a lot of performances of Bach's music, including the Passions, and brought Bach back into the kind of public eye at a time when his music hadn't been performed much. And in the later part of this movement, he brings in what feels like a Bach chorale. Is it actually a Bach?
We're not quite sure if it's really a Bach chorale, but it's certainly a chorale. And it's an amazing moment because when it comes, it feels like it doesn't belong in the movement, would you say? It's a surprise.
It's like you're listening in to something from somewhere else, or maybe you're overhearing music coming out of a church or something.
And then gradually, the chorale music combined with the stormy, conflicted music of the earlier part of the movement, and both are transformed into something new.
So I think it's sort of a musical depiction of the power of music to transform us and to, catharsis is one word for it, but it's sort of to kind of change who we are by listening to music. I think it sort of shows you that in the course of the movement. So I love playing it and hearing it. Always uplifts me.
Well, and here is Julia performing along with her sister Emily Bruskin on violin and Donna Kwong on piano, the Claremont Trio, with the finale from Mendelssohn's Piano Trio in C minor, opus 66. I'm so glad I had that performance for you. I love the way you and your trio play, Julie. It's just beautiful, beautiful performing.
Thank you so much.
We have one last work on your list, and I'm gonna tell you guys something. You're not the first ones to choose this. You're about You're about the fifth people to put this on your list. And I love it, and I'm putting it up every single time because it seems to be something that speaks so deeply to folks. Talk to us about Beethoven's Seventh Symphony.
Well, this work has so much joy in it. It just jumps off the page. The rhythms of the first movement, these dotted rhythms, are just
infectious.
Yeah, infectious.
In a good way.
Yeah, the good side of infectious.
Yeah, it's a piece I've known and played since very early in my time playing in orchestras. We had it performed at the Skinny Atlas Festival. It was our first summer, actually, and my first orchestra concert, and it was a rainy day, so we were indoors, and there was, during the beautiful slow introduction to the first movement that we'll hear, the power went down in the auditorium. I don't know, the lights went down. There was a storm. I don't know. There was something happened, and the musicians kind of just kept playing. We couldn't really see, but everyone knows that. We just love it, and we played for a couple minutes, and finally we stopped for a little bit, and then they got the power back on quickly, luckily, and then we played the rest of it. But I think, that this music somehow feels like it can rise above challenge and lift us up.
It's also very communal. You know, there's something about a symphony which brings so many players together, and that's a metaphor for all of us in society. And so it feels like the spirit of people being together. And I think that's one thing that we know we're missing now, and we're looking forward to a time when it happens again.
Concluding our section that is our celebration of life, the first movement from Beethoven's Symphony No. 7. Here's Sir George Schulte leading the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. Well, you've taken us on quite a journey with your music, time and eternity through mourning, comfort, truth, and finally a celebration of life. And I love the stories that you've been able to share with us. So I want to say thank you to both of you for spending some time and sharing this music with us. I also want to give you a chance to leave us with any last thoughts you may have on the importance of music in these times, or just anything you want to share with the listeners?
Well, thank you so much, Diane. It's been wonderful speaking with you again, you know, remotely. I think, you know, as we find in all these pieces of music, music really does connect us. Even when we can't be together in person, we can enjoy these beautiful pieces of music and experience them together, experience our unique and shared sense of humanity through them.
I would also encourage everyone to, as they're able to, support their local musicians, arts organizations, which are going through a very tough time right now. So it's a time to also reflect and come together and support each other.
I think as musicians, there's nothing we want more in the world than to be playing for our audiences again. It feels almost like a deprivation on the level of, you know, it feels really difficult to be disconnected from that, but I think in sharing these pieces over the radio, which is still possible, and in dreaming of when we'll be able to share them in person again, we have faith that this will all come back and that we'll be back playing for you again.
We definitely look forward to that time. So once again, many, many thanks to the co-directors of the Skaney Atlas Festival, Julia Breskin and Aaron Wunsch. Aaron is also a professor of piano at Juilliard and the artistic director of Music Mondays. Julia also plays in the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra and are very busily raising their children at home now and trying to keep the music alive for us as well. So once again, many thanks, Aaron and Julia, for chatting with us here today.
Thank you, Diane.
Thanks so much, Diane.